right. Well, from Bryform 2011 Chicago.
Man, this is so great. We actually have time to sit down and do a podcast in the first hour of the first day of Bryform.
And I should say, when we say we, it's Gabe, it's me, and we're sitting down here with Sean Bass.
Hello.
I don't know, probably lots of people know you, Sean, SeanBass.com, Sean Bass on Twitter.
Mr. VDI.
Mr. VDI. Fast talker, presented at nine. This is your ninth Bryform, I think, Sean, right?
Ninth presenting, 10th total attendance.
So
it's actually, you know, interesting because I feel like I kind of lucked out not presenting at the first one because now there's no bobbleheads people can point at and make fun of me.
Yeah, so for the bobbleheads, right. So we, I posted a link on Twitter. We've got five speakers who spoke at all 10 Bryforums, and we made custom bobbleheads for them, which there will be a video in the future.
Oh, yeah, and if you haven't seen it, go to check out Twitter, or is it on brianmadden.com? It's definitely in Flickr.
I did it on, yeah, so let me see if we can do that. I can post the link in the chat room.
In the chat room, yeah.
Yeah, in the Bryform bobble, the Bryform feed, you can see the...
So there's a Brian doll, of course, since he's been to all 10. There is a Tim Mangan bobblehead doll. Jeroen van de Kamp, Benny Trish, and Ron Oglesby all have bobblehead dolls that, my favorite thing to do is put them all on a table because we have like 30 of these things and just bump the table and make them all like look like they're laughing at the same time.
And without a doubt, the Tim Mangan looks like a voodoo replica.
It looks like Honey, I Shrunk the Mangan.
Dude, it is him. It is not a doll that looks like Tim Mangan. It is Tim Mangan.
Yes.
Tim Mangan is, yeah.
So we give this thing to him last night and he's like... So his wife was at the speaker dinner last night. We presented this to them at the speaker dinner, and his wife was like, "He has that outfit here.
He's going to wear it.
Here
and we'll
show.
Take pictures of him holding him.
Yeah, yeah. So he's wearing that. So that's pretty crazy. But you know, we were talking about last night, you know, best Bryform memories, and there is memories of you know, bombs and fires, which are both true things that happened in the past.
So I didn't tell you my favorite memory.
I was going to ask you. Yeah.
So I think it was the first Bryform in D.C. in 2005 that I just attended. I didn't present. And I attended Jeroen van de Kamp's session on Flex Profile Toolkit. And I remember sitting there in the session, and it was maybe 10 or 15 minutes into it, and I still didn't know what Jeroen was saying. He kept saying something like, Laurent. And I was like, what is he saying? And so it was a good 10 or 15 minutes into it until I realized he was saying log on, log off, because he's got such a heavy...
Log on, log off.
Yeah. So that was a good memory
well,
for me.
Well, Jeroen's told me since then that was the first real... he didn't really present much before. And he said, if you watch the video, he's like, I was so nervous. And when it's time to go, I just got up and started talking. I didn't even introduce myself. I didn't even introduce session. I just start talking.
I think I had similar, you know, first presenting... challenges where I was pretty well known for fitting as many possible characters on one slide as you could imagine. So it was
your slides are like you talk.
Yes, it was like a character density exercise. How many letters can you put on one slide?
Your first Bryform was that where you spoke was the one where we had the fire and the bomb threat.
Yes,
at the same time.
It was.
Yeah, which was you know the fire story.
We were trying to slow him down.
Yeah.
Well, I love it how it was like you know I think it was during lunch. And the fire alarms go off, and everyone kind of looks around and isn't really doing anything. And then, like, someone comes in from the venue and is like, you know, we got to leave. And it's like, okay, they're making us leave, you know, that kind of thing. We're on the 14th floor, 13th floor, something like that. And so we're going down the stairs, and, you know, every loop of stairs you go down another floor, and you're going down, like, so 11, 10, 9, 8.
And we're elbowing each other, like, oh,
joshing around, and there's more and more people, you know. And then on floor four... there's like smoke pouring into the stairwell from that floor.
Yeah.
Man, sobered our shit up so fast. No laughing, like, down. It was, it was cool. And then so we were out there for the fire trucks. We weren't sure how long the whole fire delay was going to last. And so a lot of people went back to their hotel. And then meanwhile, there's a bomb threat at a neighboring building.
Yep.
This is in Washington, D.C. So
in 2006, mind you, too. So
yeah,
5 years after 9/11.
It didn't matter. Like the what happened? So they closed the whole block. So we were there in our building. We didn't even know the bomb threat had happened. But everyone who went back to the hotel wasn't allowed to get back into the venue. I had good times.
That was the same one. Now, after the fire truck came, people went to the bar. Too. So there, I have a vivid memory of a guy running down the middle of the crosswalk with two beers, one in each hand, just because he was that plastered in the middle of in the middle of the day.
Yep.
And I know the guy. I'll hold his name off.
Oh, nice. It wasn't me. I don't.
No.
Yeah.
From a previous life.
So today, you know, a couple. So we don't really have an agenda. I threw out there in the chat. Maybe one of the things to talk about is the vSphere licensing changes.
Right.
And let me just kind of set this up real quick because, you know, I did three articles in 2 days on this. So everyone, I think, you know, knows the basics of licensing change. But one thing that I didn't think of, I was talking to some guy last night at the speaker dinner, one thing that didn't occur to me about the licensing change is, you know, it looks like vSphere 5, you're going to require a lot more licenses because now you're not just buying processor licenses, it's processor with a certain amount of memory.
Right.
So before, like a dual processor, 192 gigabyte server for VDI, for example, where before it would have taken two processor licenses, now even if you're buying Enterprise Plus, that only gives you 48 gigs, so you actually would need like four Enterprise Plus licenses. So it's weird because now you're going to have to look at, because people say, well, licensing changes, but if you had it in the old days, but they're just giving you one-to-one. So even if you have existing servers on Enterprise Plus for vSphere 4, then you have two licenses for that server, but you got to buy now, what, two more licenses?
Right.
Or do you buy that now $6,500 per 100-user pack for your
the
VDI
desktop
users?
Desktop virtualization.
Well, I think it depends, too, on what you're running. If people are just doing pure server virtualization, then that's not going to apply for them.
Well, let me ask you. So you have actual customers. I mean, Gabe and I, you know, we just sort of sit and chat around everything. Like, is this vSphere licensing thing? Is that something that, like, the places where you work, do they use vSphere as their platform? Do they
yes.
care about this?
Yeah, they're all VMware. And, you know, I think it's going to affect them. I think for a lot of people, it hasn't really sunk in yet what this is really going to, what the fallout's going to be. And for most of my customers, they're enterprise customers. So when you have an ELA with VMware, things are very different than if you're a small, medium
How
business.
How do those ELAs work?
It.
Are they based on like per employee or is it ELA, like you're buying 1,000 processor licenses?
It kind of depends on how the customer negotiates with the vendor. And this is true of Citrix and Microsoft and all these different companies. You can negotiate different things depending on how much volume you're buying. But I don't want to talk specifics about the ELAs because it's dependent on each customer. But, you know, I think the change in licensing for VMware was sort of inevitable if you think about what is happening with processors. You know, back when we had a socket was a processor and, you know, we started getting dual core processors, whatever, it wasn't really eating into the margins of how much profit they'd make on the virtualization stack back then. Now that we've got, you know, quad core is pretty standard and you're getting 6-way and 8-way and you know 10 core processors, it's inevitable that they had to change the licensing model. So I understand why they moved to VRAM. That makes a lot of sense. My frustration with it, and I've said this and on Twitter a number of times, if you want to charge me for RAM, then how about just give me a per gigabyte price and be done?
Yeah,
why,
like, why
do this
they...
whole processor and RAM combination that I need a PowerShell script to figure out what I need? Like, just make it simple.
Well, and that, you know, I think that's what I wrote. Like, if you know, they had a 12-page paper explaining how this new licensing model
right.
works. If it was just based on RAM, then it would be a tweet.
Right.
It says, it's not based on RAM. It's, you know, whatever it is, you know, $500 a gigabyte.
Right.
Well, maybe not that.
Yeah, not a 10-page white paper explaining how
gigabyte,
to use.
But yeah.
Yeah, you're
going
to know it's really bad when like the Microsoft people are like, wait, we don't understand this.
But so, I mean, and I guess this is all just announced. I don't know if VMware's ever, like, the backlash. So I was talking to some people there, and the VMware response, I think, is because people are, like, freaking the hell out about this licensing stuff. Like, it's all going to be more expensive. And, like, that one thread on VMware community forums, which
oh,
has, like,
so many pages.
200 things now, and it replies, everyone's freaking out about it. It's going to be more expensive. And so I talked to people at VMware, and they're like, no, people don't get it. It's a big misunderstanding, because before you're paying for all, you had to license every processor in your whole environment, and now you're only paying for what you actually use. So I'm like, well, so I guess hypothetically, if you overbuilt your environment by right. 200%, like if your environment is twice as big, then you can save money this new way. But otherwise...
Right.
It's just more expensive, right? I mean, it's yep. just, there's no other ways about it.
Yeah, and I think the thing that VMware has sort of conveyed by this new licensing model, and I said this on Twitter as well, is I feel like they're kind of saying, you know, screw Moore's law. We understand that you're going to get more RAM, you're going to get more processor, or whatever. We got to find a way to monetize that, and so we're going to adjust our licensing in order to find a way to manipulate that to keep revenue model and that kind of stuff. And again, I go back to if you want to make things easy, and you're telling people only. Pay for what you're consuming, only pay for what you're using, then just charge based on, you know, gigabyte of RAM. And it becomes very simple.
And do you think that they have to do this maybe only because their old model is not based on memory at all? It was based on processor?
I think the issue is you've got two spectrums of customers. You have those customers that build out horizontally, and you have those customers that build out vertically. And so you can't do it entirely based on VRAM. or entirely based on processor, depending on how people build either horizontally or vertically scaled. So I think the reason why they've got this combination of RAM and processor is to handle both ends of the spectrum.
So, like, you can't get around there. You can't get away from paying them, basically.
Pretty much.
But I just wonder how they seem so surprised that there's a backlash. And I just wonder who...
Well, you know, look at Citrix. Same thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when we're getting rid of CCU. Yeah. And... Oh, we've talked to all of our customers. I mean, I remember we had the CTP call where we were given a heads-up preview on this, and I told Citrix on that call, and I said, you are going to regret this. There's going to be a huge backlash, and you're going to be forced to change your licensing model. And they're like, oh, no, we've talked to all our key customers, and everyone agrees this is a great model and whatever. And what happened? Customers blew up, and all of a sudden there's this corrective licensing action. I think, to some degree, VMware's
going
to be...
Corrective licensing action. It sounds so official.
CLA.
Yes, the CLA.
VMware needs a CLA.
And I think VMware did do that. Now, you could argue that the VDI licensing structure was something that was planned all along, and I don't entirely buy that, because if it was really planned all along, then why wasn't it announced on the same day?
Well, yeah. And so I talked to their desktop folks, and said, like, you know, you could have avoided all this stuff if you just mentioned it, you know, from the day one. And like, well, honestly, it's just like different groups and one hand not talking to the other. And I'm like, I don't know.
I think you do a press conference about your new release and all these great things, whatever. I'm not buying that the two teams weren't talking.
Well, you know what Simon Crosby posted on that? He tweeted that this just goes to show how...
What
little.
Percentage of VDI?
Yeah. Like how VDI is so...
They just
like
forgot about it.
Yeah, they're like, it's, oh, yeah. We aren't telling people to do that. I forgot that we should probably mention that in the thing. Because the word desktop was not in that whole 12-page paper once,
right.
You know?
True.
And so...
Well, yeah. And they're still very hush-hush on what's happening with Vue.
Do we know anything about Vue? So. Like Vue 5. You mean like about what Vue... Hush-hush in that, like, about Vue 5, right?
Right. Well, you're not
the
even
next
supposed to
version
say...
of Vue.
You're not even supposed to say Vue 5.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Vue 5.
Yeah, I don't...
Vue 5.
We're just assuming it's Vue 5, what with it being 4.6 now.
Yeah.
We have no knowledge.
4.6.
Well, and really, it has to be 5 or, like, maybe 6 just to kind of one-up Zen Desktop. Be like, Vue 6. There. We've done it.
Corrective
+1.
Versioning. So you got corrective licensing action as a CLA. You got corrective versioning
V5
action.
Was a licensing release. V6 is...
So on that licensing, one of the questions is VSPP licensing for the vSphere? Do you know anything on that?
No, haven't really followed it much.
They said that VSPP had licenses that were more like this in the past.
Hmm.
Anyway, yeah, I don't know. So there's how good we are at those answers. No clue. So let's shift gears a little bit. Yeah, people are asking, like, you know, buzz the show, cloud jobbing, VDI or SaaS. So I'll tell you what, we have, you know, I'm trying to read and talk at the same time. So it's 10 o'clock, right? The show started at 8 o'clock, you know. I mean, we had the speaker dinner last night. I mean, what, you guys were there. Did you have any interesting conversations besides, like, I can't believe we did 10 of these things? That was my stuff.
I had to go to Radio Shack to buy stuff to fix the geek out. So some things never change.
Yeah.
What were you talking about last night at dinner?
Just having conversations, catching up with people, nothing really.
All right. And then here, look, I tried to start the buzz bandwagon in this sort of opening keynote thing. And I didn't want to talk about industry trends, because a lot of the industry trends, I mean, you know, like, no shit.
Yeah.
Hey, we're going to, you know, Windows 7. But I did talk about a couple, like issues or kind of soapbox issues for me. Sean, what did you, you came up to me afterwards and started talking about something, and I was like, let's give you a microphone.
Yeah.
I forget what did I say that you didn't agree with?
I was addressing the cloud desktop thing as something.
Oh, yeah. And we talked about that last week on the show, too.
Yeah. And so here's...
Hang on a second. Let me fill in real quick.
Okay,
It's that I'm now saying if you're doing VDI, like on a small scale, like less than 10,000 users, let's say, man, fuck it. Don't even do VDI. Like, don't build it yourself. Just go to a cloud provider, outsource it, because you can't make it cheaper than what the cloud providers can make
it. And I guess I'm not necessarily disagreeing with that. I think where my disagreement is cloud desktop versus legacy desktop. And I think the people who are looking at doing some kind of desktop strategy, it would be just as easy and cost-effective to have a on-premise MSP-style managed desktop solution than it would be to do it in VDI and not deal with the user experience issues of a cloud-hosted desktop.
Oh, wait, so you're saying that you like the on-premise MSP?
I like the idea of outsourcing the desktop management to somebody else.
Oh,
I'm
just
saying
you,
I don't know that doing it in cloud VDI, is necessarily
totally
the case.
Totally agree. Okay, right. Yeah, in that case, I agree completely.
Sure.
Yeah, because I don't like, you know, I think I said this last week, I'm big on this holes in the head thing. And I mean, VDI, you know, to me, VDI is about putting the desktop in the data center, and you only do that for very specific reasons.
Right.
And like just better management, I'm using air quotes here, is not a good reason.
Sure.
Because you can do better management with traditional desktops. And yeah, that's a good point with the MSP thing. I didn't think about that. But if people are saying, well, traditional desktops, it's hard to manage. Okay, yeah. Outsource that.
Well, and look at, you know, things like BigFix and Intune and some of those kind of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can
What did you mention?
BigFix and Intune and some of those kind of things, you know, where it's a managed provider that's managing your desktops in the traditional way with an agent-based solution, does software patching and updates and software distribution, those kinds of things, and backup and all that kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of offerings in the cloud space that can help people get rid of the complexity of IT, but not necessarily shoving it into a data center and doing VDI, because... You know, one of the areas I got into a bit of a debate yesterday on Twitter with a few people in the cloud group is that you know, this notion of private versus public cloud and doing cloud bursting and that kind of stuff. And my argument around cloud bursting is always, if your application architecture is designed to support cloud bursting, you can deal with latency and distributed architecture and that kind of stuff. The question I always have is, why aren't you running in cloud full time? Like, why would you
why
do this?
Why bother bridging? Doing it?
Why bother having... Now, I can understand if you've got legacy infrastructure in your environment that you want to continue to depreciate and get some value out of it. I totally understand cloud bursting from that perspective. But if you're looking at a long-term architecture plan, you know, going out 5 years, do you continue to buy new hardware and do this stuff internally on your own and deal with having to constantly be retrained on new hypervisors and management agents and all these kinds of things? Or do you say, hey, this application can go cloud. Let it be in the cloud 100%. Why are we going to continue to build and maintain all this stuff if we can put it in the cloud? And I think the same thing kind of applies to desktops, is if you're going to do, you know, desktop VDI or whatever, are you going to manage that stuff internally, as you're saying before, or put it entirely in the cloud? And the only area people always come up with this concern is, well, if your desktop is not so simple as it's just Office and these kinds of things, then that means I'm hosting a mail server and I'm hosting some SharePoint, I'm hosting all these other things. That's where the pricing model of these cloud providers starts to get much more expensive, because you're now hosting all these other servers and licensing and all these other things.
It's not just desktop management at that point.
Right. And then the last area along those lines that's always questionable is, what happens with ownership of data? You know, where is your data sitting? Are you sitting on co-located server infrastructure? Because if you're on co-located server infrastructure, then you've got an issue of, you know, somebody doing child pornography on a server that you're also parked on. FBI raids, rips all the drives out, and your business is shut down. This is not cloud specific. This is any kind of shared hosting. Yeah.
And all the attention being paid to that right now is being done from just the connectivity point. You know, we have like Citrix's Open Cloud Bridge,
right.
You know, connecting you to that data securely and making that so that it looks like it's sitting right next to you. So accessing the data is no big deal. Maintaining that, but I never thought about it. You can do
encryption tunnels between the endpoints and the data center, and you can do encryption of the actual data stored on disk. All of that's totally fine, but the question becomes, what if the infrastructure where your stuff is hosted is just ripped out of the racks, and you're just out of business? What do you do?
Yeah,
and you know, in some of these cases, when the FBI does these raids, it might be days or weeks before your hard drives are returned, even though there was nothing on them that, you know, they were after.
Yeah, that really sucks.
Yeah.
Your thing about, if you have less than 10,000 desktops or 10,000 users, you should put that shit in the cloud. I don't buy that, especially from a small organization. You know, a big organization that has it local is going to be able to sustain if they do have a little bit out in the cloud.
Yeah.
But a small organization, you can get that scalability with some of these smaller business solutions.
Sure.
I'm saying if a small business needs VDI, because there's not a lot of use cases for that. But if a small business has a need, there's ways to do that and keep it local and not have to worry about that kind of thing.
So the thing that I would tell people that are interested in doing cloud-hosted desktops is, don't forget, if you're going to do any kind of cloud-hosted anything, or even shared-hosted, not thinking of cloud, just like shared host web hosting or exchange hosting or whatever, that don't forget that just because someone else is maintaining your stuff, that you can automatically ignore DR plans. You know, you don't make the assumption that they're doing adequate DRBC planning on your behalf. You still need to make sure that's all being accounted for.
And in some ways, it's like they don't even have the interest. I mean, like, so, like, if you, So maybe they have an SLA that's got some, you know, like availability clause in it. But if they don't have a good DR plan, that could be a cost of doing business with them. Like if they mess up your thing and they lose you as a customer, well, so what? Life moves on.
Well, it can be a kind of thing where the, you know, the hosting provider says, you know, we're Category 5, you know, hurricane certified. We're, you know, fireproof, all these great systems, whatever. And it sounds 100 times better than anything you could do in your own offices. I mean, we could all agree that when somebody puts in a big data center, they're going to have a much better preventative measures against catastrophes and power outages and those kinds of things. But again, going back to the FBI raid thing, if you're on shared hardware and the FBI rips your hard drives out, what guarantees can that company give you that you're going to be maintaining up and running again? You know, how long will it take them to recover your stuff?
So I challenged. I mean, this is what I did during the opening keynote. I said, so here's my thinking right now. Prove me wrong. And I'd say that's
Here's the one argument.
Points to Mr. Bass.
Here's one argument I'll tweak on that a bit. If you're doing VDI in shared hosted cloud, whatever, the reality is today, the way Microsoft licensing exists, you can't be on shared hardware. Or if you are, if you are, the cloud hosting provider is violating Microsoft licensing.
Well, I thought about shared storage is allowed, though.
Well, shared storage is allowed.
Then FBI's going to rip out the shared hard drive.
That could still be a problem.
your servers are there, but all your
At that point, all you're paying for is the manageability then. The managed... What I want to say here, the managed services, really, because if it has to be on dedicated hardware anyway, what the hell is the difference? You're paying for that dedicated hardware.
Well, but they're paying for one way or the other.
They can still do it cheaper, as Brian's saying. They can
they can manage it
cheaper.
And a blade counts as dedicated hardware also.
Correct.
A single blade.
Right.
This is such crap, man. Like, the way their licensing works, like, fuck them for making us, like, have to jump through all these hoops and, you know, like, the way that we have to design our environments just so it fits in with their licensing, you know?
You could think different.
I'd rather them look at how people are doing it and just adjust accordingly instead of trying to shoehorn things into the current licensing model.
Yeah, you can adjust by learning to touch your nose to your shins.
Yeah.
Well, and let's be honest. You know, the reality of what's happening out there in the world is that people are implementing stuff incorrectly and doing it for many, many years and not realizing they're doing
ignorance.
It correctly. Exactly.
Not in a bad way, just blissful ignorance.
Right.
Like just not even knowing that.
Exactly.
Like you say, I know you said you've got a customer who didn't know they needed, I think it was a VECD,
VECD
right?
back in the day, yeah. And even the Microsoft folks that I was talking to didn't know they needed VECD.
And they probably existed for how long with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And nobody got in trouble
for it. And most of that was
right?
because Microsoft, honestly, up until VECD came out, they were letting people run in a way that they weren't really charging anything special for, and it was just sort of, you know, we won't pay any attention, we'll turn the other cheek, and you do what you want to do, and at the end of the day, you pay us a lot of money for your licensing, so don't worry about it. But then, just like with Citrix, as Citrix started becoming more popular with terminal services, Microsoft decided, wow, this is a huge market, we got to do something in this space. So what they did with Citrix was said, well, what if we just don't get you the license for NT4O? How's that going to do for you guys? And Citrix was like, oh boy. Yeah. And so then, of course, they came and met with a deal back in 97, and the rest is history. But same kind of thing with VDI. Microsoft had to do something to find a way to charge money to you know, continue the empire.
So let me ask you this then. So, and this kind of follows up with that. One of my other kind of things I talked about in the opening keynote, you know, we were talking about the future of Windows and like the windowless world and how, I'm just curious on your feedback on this. Cause like I've got this whole idea now that, you know, Windows applications, like Windows 7, you know, we're going to go through the pain to get to Windows 7, and that's the last major Windows migration we're going to do. Like, Windows 8 will be an in-place migration. But then, like, if you look ahead 5 years, yeah, we'll still have desktops and laptops that'll run Mac. We might even run Windows laptops with apps on them. We've got our handheld, you know, iOS, whatever, devices with native apps and everything. And the enterprises will still have some Windows apps. Yeah. But at some point, it'll be, you know, the Windows apps we need are, like, the minority of our applications. And we'll be like, why even bother with Windows on our endpoint, let's just put it in a VDI or whatever.
Well, I think you got to be careful when you say that because, you know, Microsoft does a number of things with their different technologies that make the experience for that technology better on a Windows platform than it is in other environments. So you look at things like Silverlight. You know, Silverlight is available to run on Linux and Mac and those kinds of things. But oftentimes the experience that you get is better than on Windows than what it is on the other platforms. Well, so Microsoft is always in the business of making the Windows desktop the best experience.
But for like .NET applications, for Windows applications, right?
Right.
But so if they make it, if the world moves off of that, and I'm not even talking like HTML5 necessarily, but like, you know, if you look at the applications that I use personally, so I use an iPad and an Android phone and a Mac desktop, and a lot of my apps, there are front ends. Like, so for example, when I'm using like our travel scheduling application. It's Concur. It works fine on the website, but I don't use Concur on Safari on my iPad. I use the Concur iOS native application because that provides a better experience. So it might be one of those things where like maybe Concur works best on a browser on a desktop, but that's not the way I'm accessing it. So like, I mean, like what applications do people use? So I kind of feel like Windows, like applications that are only Windows apps don't have these other things like out there on other devices right. are going to be these random kind of old school business apps that we can just throw in a VDI.
I guess, you know, I agree with that. And I think the problem is there's different market segments, right? So there are those companies that, you know, provide us a perk to their new employees. You know, here's an iPhone and here's, even if they're a Windows shop, they give people cool devices because that's interesting to them. But I, you know, the space that I work in, which is mostly enterprise, you know, you've still got this app portfolio of 1,000 Windows applications, and over time, yes, things will move to web, they'll move to different technologies, but it's going to be a long haul before all those Windows applications are eliminated. I'm talking
right, but I'm not talking about that these Windows apps are ever going to be eliminated. Like just like
no, I know what you're saying, and I don't think long term it poses a big challenge to Microsoft because at the end of the day, even if you have one Windows app to access by all your users, Microsoft gets the revenue. They don't really care.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter. So them, it's almost better. It's less work, right? Because they have that one old Windows app.
Well, but don't kid yourself. I mean, the meat and potatoes from Microsoft is still Windows and Office. And so if people are making alternative client platform choices that don't involve Office and Windows, that's definitely going to hurt them.
Are people making new applications in Windows today?
Yes.
This sounds stupid, right?
But absolutely.
Like if you have a brand new application from scratch, not an upgrade to something, not a little consumer widgety like dashboard, CPU monitor, I mean like actual.
Yeah. And most of that has to do with if somebody's creating an application that has heavy interoperability with Microsoft Office, you don't have a choice. You cannot create a web application that hooks to Office in a very tight way.
So that's funny though, because it's like, so the only reason people are building, I shouldn't say, but like, so that.
It's not the only reason.
A large reason.
But it's because of like the way they force, like, because of that Office.
Yeah, Office is has a lot to do with it. Yeah.
Remember, you know, we see this with VDI, especially, you know, business as usual wins all the time. I mean, hands down, you know, people don't do certain things because they just have always done it this way. And, you know, I'm not saying I agree with that, but as long as people are continuing to do business as usual, there will be apps.
I want to find, you know, I wish we could find the like statistical average user and get them on the show because, like,
we had those Muppets. We were going to do it with the Muppets.
Oh, we can make a Muppet of a user.
Average user.
The eyeballs are going in different directions.
and to be honest, like, I don't know that there's much sense in really, you know, trying to figure out how many Windows apps somebody uses. I think where a majority of things that are going to be done over the next, you know, 2 to 20 years is really going to be mobile applications. So that's really where I think there's much more interesting things to talk about than there is today in the traditional classic desktop sense.
Well, I guess probably now, like, almost no application, I don't know if I can say this, but, like, I feel like almost no application is developed just for a platform. So, like, I feel like if I'm a company, I'm building a new app, it's like, okay, this application, we're writing it for Windows, and we're going to have the iPhone. Like, I wonder, people will think about how they're delivering it to all their devices, right?
Yeah.
So, right now, Windows, like, we're using Citrix Receiver and crap like that on our iPads.
Nobody really uses that, though.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's a backwards, like, hack. Like,
right.
On the one off chance you got
it. Yeah, I mean, it's nice to be able to provide, you know, terminal services-style applications to users of iPads and iPhones and Android tablets and that kind of stuff, but you have to question the usability of it. And this is one of the things I brought up a while back with Citrix with their Project Alcatraz, where they're using, you know, traditional applications like Outlook that are form-fitted for...
What's Project Alcatraz?
That's the one where
Golden Gate, isn't it?
Oh, Golden Gate, I'm sorry. Alcatraz.
Is Alcatraz
they
the
might have one,
next?
Too. But
Sean
but
Bass leaked
batshit crazy.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Alcatraz.
So, no, but Golden Gate...
down so that...
maybe I was foreshadowing some gloom and doom for Golden Gate, but... no, but... Project Golden Gate is about, you know, form-fitting, you know, something like Outlook to a mobile form factor, whatever. But the entire application is remoted over ICA. Now, I'm a huge fan of ICA, and I think remoting applications my entire career has been built off of that technology. But at the end of the day, I feel like most people don't want to use an application remoted over a remoting protocol. I mean,
yeah,
it's a means to an end.
Sucks. When the user interface is being generated in one spot and, like, viewed in a different spot.
Right.
And with Golden Gate, rearranged and moved around. And, I mean, it's kind of complex.
Wait, so Golden Gate, this is not... I mean, God, do I even mention now?
Vertigo.
Vertigo, right?
Vertigo, yeah. No, this is not reformatting an application to run, you know, sort of natively on that side or whatever. It's actually just running an application over ICA, but formatted to the mobile form.
Okay. So Citrix, that like file browser thing they have.
Well, that was actually a native Win32 application.
Right, but so Golden Gate is taking...
No, this is actually sending HDX data across the wire. It's sending an Outlook session across the wire, but it's mixing it up, rearranging it so that it looks good on your
device.
They
have to recode the application to look that way.
Okay, so some poor sap at Citrix in the basement, I guess they're not basements in Florida, wherever they work, they have said, this, and it's like a dry, like you take this and like scraping screen and reformatting and doing that. So like, holy F.
Yeah,
but why wouldn't you just use every fucking device you're saying this thing to has a native mail application? Why would you?
Okay, so here's a good reason for that. A good reason for that is people that have very tight, constrained rules around data on endpoints. So if you're a government, military, whatever, if the Citrix session goes away on a Golden Gate session, there is no resident data on the device.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Now, one could argue there are sort of middle of the road solutions between native mail applications and hosted mail applications, like Good.
Yeah.
Where Good is a native application that contains an encrypted form of the email, where the email is not actually exposed in the native mail app.
Yeah.
So if you pick up a device and you pull the code off of it, you can't get at the email on the device because it's all encrypted. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of middle-of-the-road things.
Device encryption is like most mobile platforms have solutions for that anyway, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess you could also argue that maybe, and I don't know if this is the case, I guess it's probably coming, if not, like Outlook Web Access.
Yeah.
Like I'm assuming that there should be like an HTML5 version of Outlook Web Access that just looks awesome on an iPhone.
Right.
And when that...
Someday. It works right now. You could check webmail on your phone.
It's not as usable as it could be.
But I mean, like, they could make it recognize what platform, you know, they're connecting from. And like a lot of websites do that. Not BrianMadden.com, but a lot of others. That's actually one of the things on our list to do. To
mobile formatted.
Yeah.
I'm not even close to that myself.
But it's just going to be so, like, I think it's going to be, because we can whip it together, like, in a day. If it's just, like, top 20 articles, click on it, like, comments, you know, it should be pretty easy to do.
I'll tell you what, I'm the first guy, though, that scrolls to the bottom and says, show me the full site.
That's
so
true.
I mean, I do that so much, even on my phone.
Why?
On my iPad especially, but on my phone almost all the time. Because you can use almost every single feature on BrianMadden.com from your phone.
Like zoom, 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 and then you gotta do this. And again,
unless you're using Reader on the iOS, and then that's much better.
Do they have? So I don't have. Gosh, that Reader thing, by the way, good move.
Yeah. Except for people that are driven by marketing revenue, not such a good move.
So like TechTarget, for example.
Exactly.
Well, but the thing is,
damn you, Apple.
Can we delete? Yeah, oh shit, we're live.
No, but like, hey, the ad impressions are sold regardless, right? So until the advertisers, because it still counts as an impression.
But I guess.
Hey, until the advertisers come to us, and say, I want a discount on our ad rates because we think that exponentially many people are looking at Reader. I actually saw that initially. I haven't looked in a while, so we should pop back into Google Analytics and see how many people are connecting via Reader. But we can, I don't know, maybe go back to, like, it's like ASCII ads, and they're built into the article, and if you look at it on Reader. Because I was thinking if we did a mobile site, too, we could have mobile ads, and they were formatted of the right size, and then we could, like, sell those specifically to, like, people who make, like, mobile, you know, products or whatever. Yeah. But that's a whole other...
The big issue with mobile development today is, you know, when you're a vendor creating an application for, you know, iPhone and iPad and Android and Windows Phone, all those kind of things, it's essentially completely different SDKs, different development APIs and that kind of stuff. And it's very challenging for a software developer to put these out. And, of course, the user experience and look and feel of the apps are completely different on those different platforms. So I think you're going to start seeing a lot more uptake of solutions like PhoneGap and AppCelerator, where it's, you know, a development IDE that allows you to create the code one way and exposes the functionality on all the endpoint devices in the same fashion.
Yeah, and that's so awesome because we just want everything to be like Flash.
No, I don't think it's necessarily like Flash. I mean, Flash is a whole separate set of problems. I mean, what I'm talking about is a way that you write the application that exposes native functionality of the device. So if the device has an accelerometer, I write code one way to access an accelerometer, and it works the same way on Android and iOS and all these other kind of things.
But isn't that just like fancy Flash?
Not really.
No. What are these things you called? You said I got to write this down.
PhoneGap, Accelerator. I mean, there's a bunch of different solutions out there.
Accelerator. So... I forget what I was going to ask about PhoneGap devices native. I lost it. Never mind.
Okay.
So, okay, so let's look at what else is happening here this week, which, by the way, we've actually just gone into sessions. Was there sessions you wanted to see right now? Are we keeping you from anything?
I don't know. I haven't seen the agenda yet.
All right, so let's see. Right now we have going on.
I've got sessions to go make. Project. What are you doing? What is your session here at the...
So I'm doing two that I also did in the UK at Bry Forum, London.
How did we let you get away with that?
I don't know. It was pretty cool. but I did this session with Benny Tritch on remoting protocols. So we compare RDP versus HDX versus PC over IP versus
And this
DOP
is like the second or third time for that.
Yeah, we keep revving it and kind of tweaking it. And we're also looking at doing future versions where we'll break out and instead of showing all the, you know, 15 suite of tests that we do right now, we're thinking of just showing like audiovisual sync of QuickTime versus Windows Media, whatever.
And just, if you care about that.
Just tackle one specific area.
Yeah.
Or we're thinking about maybe, you know, taking each protocol and saying, what are some performance tweaks you can use over these given conditions to make it perform better and just show people how to do those tweaks.
That's one of the problems we have. And people ask me this all the time, which protocol is best?
Yeah.
And
the answer is always, it depends.
Well, so what is your answer?
It depends.
Damn it.
Yeah.
People
always ask me, they say, you know, what amount of kilobytes per second do I need for XYZ protocol?
Oh, yeah,
and the answer is, I don't know. It depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you're using Notepad all day, you can get by with, you know, 5 to 10 kilobits per second.
So
if you're using scrolling around in PDFs or watching movies, you're talking 3 to 5 megabit.
So let's go through this protocol list. could we play word association?
Yeah.
I'll give you a protocol and you give me one word, right? First thing.
Oh, this could be depends. Bad. I don't know
depends.
If I want to do this.
Depends. Right. Depends.
So, Quest EOP.
Very good.
All right. Aircom Blaze.
Fair. Right. Fair.
ICA HDX.
Very good.
You already use very good.
What?
All right.
Oh, I can't use it again. Well, you didn't tell me that when we started out.
Remote effects.
Excellent for certain use cases.
RDP.
Very poor in WAN conditions.
RGS.
Very good, actually, I'll use it again now 3 times.
So it's unique.
Okay, that's good.
Well, let's go back. So, I mean, RDP is sort of the baseline, I guess, for any test you do, right?
Yeah.
Like, is RDP usable today?
Absolutely. Yeah. So our RDP really doesn't have problems on a typical network until you hit about somewhere between 75 and 125 milliseconds, and it kind of depends on how much bandwidth you have and if you've got packet loss and those kind of things. All remoting protocols don't do a great job with things like packet loss. You know, UDP-based ones like PC over IP tend to do a better job than some of the TCP-based protocols just because of the connection-oriented nature of TCP.
Is it true? Because I'm not a network guy, but it seems to me that UDP is a better protocol for doing
absolutely.
Remoting,
I mean,
right?
for doing display remoting, UDP is a better
so
protocol.
So who does that?
That's just PC over IP. That's Teradici and VMware View.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, no one else. Well, no one else publicly today is using UDP for anything.
Oh, so that suggests that you know someone else privately is going to do it in the future.
I didn't say that.
Oh, I didn't,
you didn't
say
have
that. You
to.
Can't prove anything. okay, that's cool. Nice. By the way, so you mentioned RemoteFX.
Yeah.
Good for certain. What was your association? Good for certain.
It's good for certain things. I mean, RemoteFX is not designed so. The two protocols that people often use for high-end CAD-CAM kind of stuff is like HPRGS and HDX 3D Pro, and the Teradici one-to-one solution also falls into that. So really good for, you know, doing CAD-CAM design, those kind of things over fairly high bandwidth networks. RemoteFX really wasn't designed to do that. RemoteFX is really designed to deliver some rudimentary 3D graphics, Windows Aero, and some simple stuff like that. It's not really designed to do high-end 3D CAD and that kind of stuff. And the reason for that is they are using a GPU, but they're assigning a VRAM allocation per user where you're getting sort of a slice of the memory of that graphics card. So if you look at what most people are doing for CAD-CAM, they're getting a 2 or 4 gigabyte video card dedicated to each user on sort of a one-to-one basis, and that's not what RemoteFX was designed for.
So
it can do 3D graphics, but it's not designed for high-end.
Which is kind of that's kind of a big misconception, right? People think it's like GPU-based remoting, and it's like really it's just regular Windows remoting that just coincidentally happens to use a GPU as its server-side encoding processor.
Correct.
So, but what you're saying, in a nutshell, is that you know, if you're using RemoteFX, you need your GPU for doing the RemoteFX encoding, and there's not like enough left to actually do the 3D graphics.
I wouldn't say there's not enough left. I mean, today, Microsoft doesn't expose any way for you to alter the way in which that VRAM is allocated. I hope that somewhere in the future they allow you to say, I only want to have 4 people use this machine and let me allocate, you know, 500, 600 VRAM per user.
Like, okay, right. Oh, so they can... per user for actual GPU stuff.
Right.
Not just the remote
not just the encoding and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So hopefully they'll allow you to do more with tweaking it in the future than just the out of box experience you get today.
So Aircon Blaze, is that like that's an accelerator?
RDP. Yeah.
It's native RDP that they've done some reverse engineering to make it perform a lot better. And for certain things, Blaze does a much, much better job than RDP. If you look at normal high level bitmaps on RDP, if you're connected in over a WAN, you get that tiling effect where each thing kind of paints at a time.
Yeah.
Blaze doesn't have that. It's sort of a compressed image, sort of like how HDX does things.
You can buy Blaze. Like, you can just buy it from them. Like, you don't have to buy the Aircon suite, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can just buy it as a standalone thing just for one-to-one endpoint connections.
So if you have slow connections or some users are slow, like, Blaze may be the way to go.
Absolutely.
How about RGS? Mm-hmm. Like, what's HP doing with that? Because
I'm not really that in tune with what HP is doing with RGS. I've just
sitting right behind us. We can ask him later, I guess.
Yeah, I've just done some limited work with it in the past with a couple customers and that kind of stuff. And it's, again, primarily suited towards people that are doing CAD CAM design kind of work and stuff like that. I haven't really seen it as a wide stream accepted solution for.
They've got this flight simulator thing in here in their booth.
Yeah,
that's connected to, like. Is that showing RGS? Have you seen that yet?
I've not seen the demo. But the thing, I always challenge all these vendors here, and it's really cool to see, a thin client or a desktop or something like that sitting next to a server, and they're running all these cool, crazy graphics. I'm like, yeah, that's all cool and everything, but can you show me something real world, like not these two things sitting 3 feet apart from each other, but can you show me like this thing running halfway across the world? Because that would impress me.
I don't want to see another movie trailer.
Yeah, exactly. I've had enough of the Big Buck Bunny or whatever.
I feel like the thin client vendors are going to, like, just build that thing into the firmware, like the cache at the end of the firmware.
Yeah, exactly. So, they just start serving it out of a RAM chip.
And I know you guys use a WAN simulator.
Yeah.
We used to use
Shunra Desktop VE, just a software-based emulator, and we switched to the Apposite Linktropy Mini 2, which has worked really well for all of the TCP-based protocols. We've run into some issues with it because of how they do the packet drop.
Yeah, what's up with Teradici, I know, like, last time you guys did this, like, they were pissed at your results. They're mad at you guys because they thought that your guys, like, they didn't like the way you tested.
They didn't like the device that introduced the.
No, what I heard is that I saw them last December, I was up in Vancouver meeting with them, and they're like, you tell Sean and Benny that, like, their test is messed up, and, like, it was
on one of your articles, they sort of attacked a number of different things about our methodology, and one of them was they said something about, we used WordPad as the application, and nobody uses WordPad, and they can't efficiently remote WordPad because of the way that it paints things on the screen, whatever. And, I wasn't going to say anything back in that article, but I thought, all right, if you're calling me out and you're attacking me for my methodology, okay, I use WordPad because it was in the operating system. It was easy to fire up. It was easy to scroll through an RTF file. And every other protocol seemed to do a great job with it but you. So, I don't know. Maybe you should optimize your protocol to work with WordPad, and then we wouldn't have this discussion.
Yeah, so, what about other apps that were written the same way?
You were doing software, though. Because I thought they're looking at just the signal off the back. But I guess we've done testing
both with VMware Vue, the soft, and with the Teradici hardware.
Yeah.
So we've done both.
So on the software, on the hardware side, it shouldn't matter. Like, WordPad doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter what you're doing.
Correct.
Right?
It's just on the software and the
software
Vue
encoder. Yeah. So how is that, like, resolved now?
The test results we did with Vue 4.6 were actually pretty good. We had some pretty positive results with Vue 4.6, and I'm hoping that.
So you haven't changed your rig at all, but the results are positive. So no problem.
Well, and so here's the things too. We've changed, as Benny and I have done this remoting protocol, we've changed things a number of times. When we started this whole effort, we were using Windows XP. There wasn't any Windows 7 that we were testing with, whatever. Yeah. And so introducing Windows 7 has made it a lot more difficult for a lot of these vendors because they maybe don't do such a good job with Aero, because Aero changes everything in terms of the transparency and everything else. So we've had some struggles with that, just introducing Windows 7 and Aero, that has made some of this more challenging on the hardware side.
Moving ahead, you're doing more specific testing. And
yeah, so I think this will probably be the last just straight up, here's the four protocols and here's all the 15 or 20 different tests that we do for Silverlight and Flash and all these different media display protocols and GDI and all that kind of stuff. We'll probably still continue to do that, maybe revise that once every year or two, adapting it for new releases of Zen Desktop and Vue and those kinds of things. But I think what we're going to do is take it in a different direction and say, maybe sort of like how Project VRC did their phases, we're going to try to do phases of the remoting protocol comparison. So the next phase might just be AV Sync. And in the case of AV Sync, we'll maybe just choose a couple different multimedias, like Windows Media, QuickTime, and Flash, or something like that. And we'll show each of the protocols just by themselves in a video, because you can't test AV Sync with four videos at the same time, because you wouldn't be able to follow.
Do you have Spice in there, too? In that mix?
We do not have Spice right now. We've
Wait, is that now with...
Red Hat.
Red Hat? And Virtual
Bridges. It's open source now, right?
There is an open source version of it, but Red Hat still owns the protocol, so they've opened up some of it, but they've also retained some of it.
Virtual Bridges licensed from Red Hat, or
they use the open source one, and they, you know, the open source version of Spice does not have USB support, and so Virtual Bridges had to roll their own, or they actually licensed it from somebody else and implemented it in there. But so Red Hat has some of their own features that they add to Spice, and but there is the open implementation too.
Fracturing, we're seeing. It's like, so, Sean, you were saying about Spice.
Well, we're not doing Spice right now, and I'm not exactly sure where it's going to fit in necessarily. I mean, my understanding of Spice, and I'm not that well connected to it, but my understanding is it's really designed to be a LAN-based protocol and not a WAN-based protocol. And a lot of the testing that we're doing today is about the WAN.
Because all these work fine on the LAN. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. If you compare all these protocols in a LAN-based scenario, you're going to look at them, and you're not really going to see much of a difference.
Yeah.
So it's not that entertaining to show a four-up video of a LAN-based remoting protocol, because you're like, oh, they're all the same. Great. Oh, that's excellent.
Right.
So we really only focus on WAN-based scenarios. And the reality is today, with a lot of telecommuters and that kind of stuff, more and more people are having to deal with the WAN as the regular means of connection.
How about these hardware add-in cards? Both Teradici and Microsoft were talking about these. I thought they were saying this year, right?
Those are really designed, from my opinion, those are really designed just to increase the scale of which you're able to roll out your virtual desktops. It's not really designed necessarily to make the user experience better.
All right, but you don't have any like inside.
I don't
think
Teradici has released their cards yet. Yeah. As far as I know.
Hey, so Ryan Gallier is writing, sorry, buddy, it was like 20 minutes ago. Thin Client OSs, you know, Windows Thin PC. What do you think about these kinds of things? But Gabe, you got a session on that.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about this last week, did we?
I don't think so. I have a.
Did we, Justin? No, I don't think so. All right.
I have a 15-minute session today, actually. I thought it was tomorrow. So when we're done with this, guess
right
what
now.
I'm going to go do.
Oh, right.
Is it? No. So it's just a real quick take a look at ThinPC, what you can do with it, even maybe though you shouldn't be able to do. Because you know, when I first got it, I was excited. It's a tiny OS. It takes up a very small footprint. You can install Office on it.
It's like Windows Fundamentals. It's like the V7 version of that.
And it looks like Windows 7. I mean, it's gorgeous. Come to find out, you actually are not allowed to do any of that stuff, though. You are only allowed to put antivirus and remote desktop.
Oh, so it's real Windows 7.
You are not allowed to put business applications.
Oh, so you can't.
Did you really think they were going to let you do that?
Well, here's the thing, though.
You have SA.
They haven't prevented you from doing it.
Wait, right. But you already have it. You can only get this through SA, right?
You can only get it through SA.
So who the fuck cares what you install on it? Well, I guess they're just dicks about licensing about everything, so like, might as well add it to the pile.
Yeah. I guess.
Well, because they probably don't want you to do a limited version of Windows when you can run the full version.
But you already own the full version.
No, I understand. It's not a licensing issue. They just want to. It's this thing of the Windows experience. The best Windows experience comes from the full flavored Windows 7 and not the scaled down version.
I suppose. But I still have Internet Explorer. I still have Arrow.
How about the steady
state?
So Ryan's right about the steady state. It's like a write filter thing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Thin Client OSs have that same functionality too.
Does Windows 7 have it?
You can do steady state on Windows 7.
Yeah?
Yep,
so you don't
absolutely.
Even need ThinPC to get steady state.
Correct. I mean, steady state really is designed around, you know, lab PCs or shared PCs or something like that, just to revert them back. It's sort of like, think about like a virtual disk snapshot that you just sort of revert back. It's not the same technology. It's not doing it at the disk level. It's doing sort of like a change log and reverting the change log. But it's the same basic concept.
I like, so on these Thin Client OSs, we have Stratodesk. Is a company.
Oh, Ryan says steady state is not Windows 7 supported. That's interesting.
All right.
I thought that it was.
We had actual listener interaction, too. So, I think you get a...
Okay,
thank you.
So maybe I'm thinking back in the XP days.
I mean, ThinPC does have write filters that you can use. So, I mean,
is it just
still,
like the XP
still
embedded? Is it like the embedded write filters?
Yeah, it's bigger than that, but similar. Yeah.
that's kind of funny. I think I told you last week. You know, the only time I actually enjoyed using XP embedded or Windows 7 embedded was when I turned off the write filter and just used it.
Yeah,
seems like a fun little thing.
So to the point there about thin client OSs versus thin PC. At the end of the day, I mean they're achieving the same function, right? You know, you're getting a stripped down client operating system to connect into a remote protocol full desktop. I think the real question comes down to what operating system is a thin client OS, and what is that going to change about the user experience of the remoting protocol?
Because I look at it from management. So ThinPC is remote effects, but ThinPC, like, if I can't, I have to manage that thing.
The
thin client OSs are the exact same. It doesn't matter whether it's Wise or HP or anybody else. If Windows embedded, if it's a Linux stripped down thing, there's still management. It's just you're buying the management thin client vendor.
I mean, I have to patch it.
Right.
I mean,
you still have to do things with the firmware based ones. You still have to maintain them.
But I'm running Windows, you know. So I feel like this doesn't save me anything going to ThinPC. My point is that ThinPC doesn't save me anything. So if I'm not allowed to do productivity apps on ThinPC, forget that, man.
Microsoft would argue that, you know, ThinPC gives you additional flexibility with the management provided.
Well,
yeah.
How about this LISTCON? So this company called LISTCON, not called Stratodesk. They have a product. I don't know if you heard this. They're the sponsor of our Internet Access Lab, and they basically took. I think it's based on some kind of Linux. They basically wrote their own thin client OS to replace like ThinPC, ThinOS, Blazor, whatever. So you have all these different thin clients, all these different makes and models, and they're like ARM and they're, you know, like Intel. It's all these different things, and you buy the OS from them. And so you can then like boot on demand. You can reflash with the firmware, and they can run on PCs even, and like repurpose anything.
Yeah. See, the thing I'd say is the same thing about thin clients. What is the user experience trade-offs that you're going to make in using any operating system? If it's Linux, if it's Windows, if it's whatever, you need to go back to your VDI or terminal services vendor and find out what feature set you will sacrifice by using that operating system.
So you mean because like the Citrix, so if you're using like Zen Desktop, the receiver for Linux is worse than receiver for
today
full Windows.
Today it is, yes.
In terms of like fewer functions. So if you go with this Stratodesk, I think they call it like no client or something. I don't remember.
Right.
Then that's cool. But remember, you're using not the Linux client. And like look at the VMware Vue client for Linux.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I guess. Does
well,
it
I think Citrix is really interesting
well,
too.
It's the open
as a
client, the source is out for this open client that you can implement.
Yeah, but you know, the source has been out for RDP for 10 years, and how many RDP flavors do you see for all these different
and
OSs?
So,
but I think you know when you look at picking a particular operating system for a thin client device, you got to see what those trade-offs are. And the first things to look at is, you know, any kind of client-side remoting of multimedia and that kind of stuff. You know, are GDI primitives supported? That's only going to be supported on a Windows endpoint. What about printing? You know, and Citrix is a great example of a company to look at because Citrix is so much embracing the Apple culture with everything that Mark talks about, and yet the Mac client is one of the biggest pieces of crap that Citrix has. So you seem kind of conflicted.
Hey, they're working
like
on it.
You go to Synergy and you hear like, rah, 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 we're virtualizing Mac OS, whatever. Yeah, it's like, you've been working on a client for like 9 years and it's still a piece of crap. So, you know, I don't know. I'm not bitter.
So that your first session was we were talking about the remoting protocols. You've got it.
Right. Oh, so yeah. So my second session is dealing with IE6.
Where is it? I don't see it here on this.
It's on Thursday, I believe.
I made the schedule.
Oh, dealing with, this session. Okay, so the backstory on this is every once in a while we accept sessions without even reading the descriptions.
Sweet.
And this is one of those, so dealing with IE6.
Yeah, so as you guys know, IE6 is you know, a very, very legacy browser that no one wants to support. The reality is in the enterprise space, you still have numbers of applications that will not work on IE8, even with, you know, compatibility view mode, which only really renders it in IE7 compat model. And you know, companies are forced to find something to do with these applications. And if the application, it's a web-based application, uses IE6, or maybe it's an application that uses the embedded web browser object, if you can shove something like that into Citrix or terminal services, whatever, maybe that's a nice, easy solution. But when you have an application used by 10,000 people, that all of a sudden doesn't become practical.
Do you just walk up on stage, say ThinApp, and then leave?
No, not necessarily.
But that's illegal, you know, right?
Well, that's so.
No, hang on.
It is.
So it's a backup. Yeah, I don't mean ThinApp's illegal, but if you use ThinApp to put IE6 on Windows 7,
that's Microsoft does not support more than one browser on an endpoint operating system, period, end of story. Whether you're doing it through app virtualization or not, they do not support multiple flavors of IE in the same operating system.
So it's not just the licensing people that are that are dicks.
Yeah, it? Not only is it illegal, it's also not supported.
And I suspect it has something to do with the European Union ruling against Microsoft about the browser being part of the operating system, whatever. If they allowed people to believe it was completely segregated from the operating
that
system,
kind of breaks down the
then
little,
it breaks
little
down
little
their argument about it being part
it's
of the
so
operating
integrated.
System.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's my theory. I don't know that to be the case. I just suspect that might be
like
something
to do. No, I like a good conspiracy theory, so I'll buy that.
Well, I mean, if it can be done, you ask at Microsoft, if other people can virtualize IE6, why can't you? And they're like, oh, well, there's things that prevent us from doing it. But there's not.
There might be legal things that prevent them
from
doing it.
Yes, they are not,
It's not they're lawyers and they're accountants.
Right.
But so is that the thing? Like, is that the main thing? So when you talk about coping with IE6, is it about doing app virtualization and putting it out in Windows 7?
App virtualization is one of many solutions that can help you address IE6 compatibility. Type 2 hypervisor solutions like MedV and VMware Ace and some of those kind of things are also another solution. Serving it up in Browsium is another option for customers that want to.
What's Browsium?
Browsium is a IE6 rendering engine that installs on the machine. It basically does
like a browser plugin.
Exactly. There's a browser helper object that specifies which URLs go to the IE6 rendering engine versus which ones go to the IE8/7 rendering engine. But actually, Browsium is a startup from a bunch of the people that used to lead IE development at Microsoft.
Really?
They spun off and created this company because they recognized that since Microsoft wasn't doing anything with this, they could make a business model off of creating an IE6 compat engine.
Wow. What does Jack Donaghy call this? The whole integration, like where the people that sell you the chips that give you diarrhea also sell you the diarrhea medicine?
Yeah.
But what is that? He had a word for that, right?
I thought it was like vertical integration or something.
I thought
it was funnier than that.
That's what this did. They write this crap that is not compatible with anything, get the whole world to move all their business apps onto it, then they quit and they start up their own company.
Yeah, and then Microsoft says, we don't want to do this anymore. And they're like, fine, we'll go over here and still do it.
I think more power to them. And at the end of the day, the folks at Microsoft, even though it's not legal to run these multiple copies of the browser and that kind of stuff, Microsoft wants people off IE6 any possible way that can happen. They don't go out and publicly say this, but they got their countdown IE6 website. They want IE6 to die so that they can move things forward.
Why do we not have this issue with like IE5 and IE4 and all those previous ones?
Most of it was because Microsoft dropped a lot of the old capabilities of IE6. They left it behind in IE6 and didn't carry it forward. So there's no forward compatibility with those things. So
the world had to go to IE6, sort of the world had to convert all our crap to IE6 when that came out.
Well, IE6 wasn't really revolutionary in terms of the number of things that it supported. So moving from 4 and 5 and 5.5, there wasn't really any major capabilities changes. It was just it was natural evolution. But from IE6 to IE7 and 8, there were such major changes in the browser that some of the old legacy applications just would not be compatible unless Microsoft made it backward compatible. And they chose to not do that. So they just said, all right, we're cutting it off here.
So that's is this hopefully next year this will not be a session, right? Because it will be fixed.
Definitely. Definitely.
What's if I can't watch your session, what's the best way to cope? Don't give me it depends. What do you like? IE6.
It depends. No, man, I don't know.
It's not do.
So I think it depends on the use cases that you have. And like I said, if you've got a handful of applications you're dealing with for IE6 compatibility, then you're going to throw them up in a terminal services if you can do that. If you've got several thousand users, you're going to have to use an alternate solution. So MedV might be that solution for you. App virtualization might be that solution. Browsium might be that solution. But it's going to depend on how many web apps you're dealing with, how many of them have tight integration with other applications. Because the problem with AppVert that you can run into is if I have to tightly couple this application with Office, now I got to virtualize Office with it and do all these other kind of things. So it gets to be a much bigger problem.
So we've got just a couple minutes left. I guess, like you said, this is the internet. We can talk as long as we want, but I really have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Me
too.
I kind of talked about what I wanted to get out of Briform. Like, you two guys, what are you hoping to? Like, why are you here now? Like, hopefully, it's not just to present, right? Like,
you promised me beer.
I want to see Howl at the Moon. Yeah.
That'll be interesting.
They wrote a song. We got to read the lyrics to the song, and the only thing I will say is that there's a custom written song that they will be singing at Howl at the Moon, and it is to the tune of Free Fallin' by Tom Petty.
So,
and it looks pretty funny.
The thing is, it's so Howl at the Moon is our party tonight. I don't think we said that earlier yet, right? So Howl at the Moon, it's a dueling piano bar. The the two sponsors of the party tonight are both Absence and Rez.
Completely by accident. You know, because those were sold through different channels. There's two sponsorships for the party, and you know, their sales reps did their job, and just lo and behold, we look at the sponsor list for the company party or for the Bryform party, and it's Absence and
by the way, those vendors were listed alphabetically for those in the audience that might have thought that, you know, Brian mentioned Absence first for a reason.
Yeah.
It was an alphabetical organization.
Well, so we told the people at the piano bar to, like, you know, like, have fun with it and fun with the kind of competition. But we were like, but please make sure that none, like neither side wins. We love them both equally.
Each piano player is wearing a shirt. So one has an Absence shirt on and one has a Rez shirt on. I'm sorry, one has a Rez shirt on, one has an Absence shirt on.
I see what you did there.
Gabe did it the other way, yeah. Well, hey, let's wrap this up. So thank you all for the folks who were listening and chatting with us live. Thank you for that. We'll get this MP3 posted in the next 15 minutes. Can I say that, Justin?
Say whatever you want. It'll get done when it gets done.
I don't know. So, you know, look at us though. We said we want to do a show. We've done it twice in a row. Same schedule both times. Next week, I'm going to be in Australia, doing 5 road shows in 5 days. Quest Software sponsoring that. It's 1 a.m. local time. And I'm hoping to actually do the show live from Australia with you guys back in this end. So we'll see what happens. I got Rick Mack with me down there. Got Rob Malicote. A couple of really great
big voice
guys. Great guys are going to be down there. So we will, we'll do that. We'll do that next week, and hopefully it'll come on. Sean, thank you for.
Well, thanks for having me.
If you want coming back in via Skype, you know, anytime, future weeks is a cool conversation. So
sounds good.
All right, all. Well, thank you so much for listening, everyone.